History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there that should not go untold. And they won't go untold as long as people like you and I are willing to take a little time to ask a few questions and, most importantly, to listen to what some of our more experienced Americans have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. All of us have just experienced a Christmas unlike any in recent memory. The specter of COVID-19 creating concerns and at times dilemmas that we've never had to deal with before. But interviewing World War II veterans over the last 15 years has helped me understand that so many have gone through so much worse in Christmases past, and I thought we'd pick up a little perspective today from some of their Christmas time experiences in World War II. We're going to start with a man who earned a Purple Heart on Christmas Day, 1944, in Belgium. Philip Houck had survived Omaha Beach on D-Day, but his attempt to celebrate the occasion on Christmas nearly cost him his life. We'll lead into that with his memories from the early stages of the Battle of the Bulge with the 502nd Engineer Company.
One of the reasons that our company was sent in was that we were noted for the fact that we could build a bridge 165 feet long over a ravine, whether it was a canyon or a river or whatever, in less than 3 hours, and have it prepared to take small tanks, trucks, and jeeps. And we could do it 2 a day if we had to, if we had the equipment. Many of them we built at night. Now, they're steel. So remember, at night you don't want to make a lot of noise, because if you do, you could have 88 shells in your hip pocket.
You could have some other steel heading your way.
That's right. So we used leather hammers. Mm-hmm. The hammers were about 3 pounds. And that bridge was so well built that everything just fit. And it was all built by hand.
And for you specifically, in terms of, I mean, I'm assuming every guy had a different job in putting,
yes,
that bridge together that fast. So what was your specific duty? Was it the same every time you did a bridge? Did you have to know a variety of roles? How did that work?
My role was to line up the detonation, set the detonation, make a map to show where the charge could be set from, and then put the charge on the steel as it was going across.
On every single bridge, you had to do that?
Yeah.
Were you ever responsible for detonating it too? Or that?
No, but I've detonated a lot of stuff.
Now, you say that with a wry smile on your face, as if you enjoyed some of those detonations.
I know I speak of Earl Couch a lot, because if you bunk with a guy and sleep in the sand with him and dig a hole and sleep with him and eat with him, talk with him every day, you get to be pretty close. So he was my right-hand man, and I was his left-hand man, I guess. When we were leaving the Ardennes after building this mud bridge, we called it, we left there sometime early morning. It was still dark. And we drove to Liège, and we knew something was on. It had to be the 17th or the 18th, maybe later. Time, we don't know. I don't know. But as daybreak came, there were hundreds of doctors and nurses and patients laying in the streets, still bleeding. The Germans had sent through battalion of their army, all dressed in American uniforms, and they slaughtered everybody that was there.
Mm. So when you saw all those doctors and nurses and you saw all these patients, these wounded soldiers sprawled all over the snow, That was the aftermath of the Malmedy massacre?
That was right, yeah. It was just, they probably were there just a few hours ahead of us because blood doesn't run that long.
That's true. So had you been a few hours different, there's another instance where you would have been slain just like they were.
Oh, sure. But anyway, we left there and I went to Holland. They were afraid the Germans were going to come on through to Antwerp. And we were in Holland, I think, 4 days, blowing up bridges and making it real tough for them to come forward. And then I went back to Liège to help out at the Battle of the Bulge. And that night, Lieutenant White had asked for two volunteers, and he pointed to Earl Couch and me, and he said, you guys see if you can't get some ammo and some blankets into Bastogne. And he said, we'll set you up with some extra gear. So we started out about nightfall and driving with a compass. We got into the first checkpoint. They asked us, of course, the password, and we told them it was Butterfly that night. And we unloaded everything there and then turned and went back. Now, I drove in heading the team, and Earl Couch drove back out. We got out onto one of the highways into Liège, and I'd like to back up a little. My wife had sent me, or my future wife had sent me, a can of Planters peanuts, and we were going to save them for Christmas Day. And Earl Couch, his mother, had baked him a loaf of bread and hadn't finished baking it and put a bottle of Schlitz in the loaf of bread. And so we were saving those for Christmas Day. And we got out onto this little highway, and I could see Earl waving his hand as motion to stop. And so you stop about 200 yards apart, between 100 and 200. And he said, hey, it's Christmas, get the peanuts. And I reached up, picked up the peanuts, turned around, shut the door. And then the next thing I remember, Earl Couch was holding me in his arms. And a lone 88 had hit the bar pit on the right-hand side of this big truck. Apparently, I was close to the tire, front tire, when it happened. And most of the shrapnel that got to me went through everything else. So I only had some small holes in my back, about 18, I think they said. But it had collapsed my right lung. I know I went to Liège because he said, I'm just taking off for Liège with you now. But I never remembered Liège. The next thing I remembered, I was in a padded cell in the hospital in Paris, and this beautiful woman come in, a little nurse. I said, you got me all strapped down here. And she said, yes, and we're going to keep you there until you act like a gentleman. And I said, well, what did I do? And she said, well, you were so bad with battle fatigue, she said, you wouldn't let anybody touch you.
Wow.
So I stayed there for 3 months. And in April the next year, I came home, and I married my wife April the 22nd, 1945.
So you're wounded, you're in the hospital, and thankfully, I guess you don't have any recollections of
how I got there.
How you got there or what it was like, and obviously you were behaving in a way that they found hard to handle.
Yeah.
And that was not uncommon at that time.
No.
A lot of guys dealt with that.
They call it battle fatigue.
We've heard of guys being shell-shocked, and now, of course, we know PTSD.
Yeah.
Is that something that you ever had to deal with again in all the years since?
Once in a while, I have a little problem. Most of my problems are at night. I'm usually wringing wet with sweat.
I know it's not something that's fun to talk about, but it's real. And I've known so many men who have dealt with this for decades after the war. My grandfather was the same way, nightmares for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for the rest of us to realize the price, not only that you paid then, but that you've really paid since then. And it does take a toll on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll have one, I'm sure, tonight.
Thanks to me bringing all this up for you. And I apologize. Well, that makes us all the more appreciative for you and your willingness to talk about all this. And I want to ask about something a little more pleasant. You just kind of referenced it. all that time in the hospital, at some point you remember, hey, there's a girl back home who's going to marry me, and now I got this million-dollar wound. I'm going to go back there, and I'm going to seal the deal. So what was it like when you actually saw her again? Where were you? How'd you meet up?
Well, of course, when Earl took me to Liège, I was put on AWL, or lost in action. So my mother was sent a letter that I was lost in action, or a wire, and she advised Beverly and the family, and they did not hear from me. I think it was in February.
So they didn't know if you were alive or dead?
No. So I wrote to her and told her I was in the hospital, but not to worry. And of course, that's the first thing that they do. As soon as you tell them, don't worry, they worry.
Of course.
But I called her when I got to New York. That was a beautiful sight. I was in a wheelchair, and they wheeled me up on top deck, and we went by the Statue of Liberty. And they had boats shooting water and firecrackers and and 21-gun salutes. And that was a nice time. And I was in New York, and I called my mother, and when she heard my voice, she passed out. So my dad got on the phone, and he said, now, who the hell is this? Here, his wife was laying on the floor. And I said, it's your son, Philip. Of course, he broke up. And so when they got all shook up, I thought, well, I better not call Beverly. I'll send her a wire. So I sent her a wire, and she got it at lunchtime when she came home from work. So she wasn't able to go back to work. I called her that evening, and she said, I'm going to be on the next train. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm coming to New York. And I said, well, don't. She said, well, I want to see you. I'm coming. And I said, no, because they're going to take me to DeWitt General Hospital in Auburn. It was a lung hospital at that time in Auburn, California, and it was closer to my home.
Yeah.
My parents. And I said, why don't you just wait till I get there? And she said, well, you'll have to come through Ogden. Let me come and see you on the train. And I said, well, honey, I don't think they're going to let you close to that train. You know, there'll be guards all over.
Right.
Can't you just wait? She did, finally. Then when I got to DeWitt General, I said, you know, I said, I've been engaged for 3 years, and my future spouse, my wife, wants me to come and see her and to get married. And the doctor said, well, I've met a lot of damn fools in my time. But he said, a man still in the hospital wanting to get married is a little bit out of my reach. But he said, if you think you can make the trip, I'll give you a 10-day pass. They took me down to Sacramento, and I got on a train there, and Beverly came to Ogden from Pocatello.
Ogden, Utah.
Yeah, and uh-huh. and met me in Ogden. I pretty near wore out my kisser, I think. But we've had a wonderful life.
And did you have to go back to the hospital after that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I was still a patient, and so then Beverly and I drove. We didn't have a car, but I had $300. And I bought a 1939 Ford Coupe, V8 Ford Coupe, for $295. It was in pretty good shape for an old car. And we drove to DeWitt General, and I got her a place to stay in town. And I was still on the base, but weekends I could get away, and she'd come out once or twice during the week, and we'd go to a movie or something. And that was in April. In May, I was discharged, the latter part of May.
If that shrapnel had done more than puncture his lung back on Christmas Day in 1944, he would have missed out on 71 years of marriage before his passing 4 years ago at the age of 96. But I want to share just a few more of Mr. Houck's words with you. Remember, he had survived D-Day on Omaha Beach and the entire Normandy campaign before his wounding during the Battle of the Bulge. Here's what he said when I asked him what the rest of us should understand and remember about what he and so many more did so many years ago.
I would like you to remember that had we not won that day, our lives in this country and across the world would very definitely have been different, even to the point that you may have been speaking German today. And to remember that those men gave their lives that we might have freedom. Freedom's not cheap.
No, it surely is not. And as we move from Christmas into the new year, let's make sure that we remember all the men and women who are serving in our armed forces today. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more Christmas memories from World War II, including two men who, for different yet similar reasons, always cringed when hearing one particular Christmas melody. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.